Hey everybody, this is So Many Sequels, your book club for movies. I haven't said that in a long time. You remember? You guys remember
Whoa.
That?
I forgot.
I do.
I know. Forgotten tagline.
Marketing. I still like it, personally.
I'm Josh. I do too.
I'm Garrett.
I'm David. I'm kind of over it. I think we need a rebrand.
Already? We did. I don't feel we kept it long enough.
Never give it a chance.
The only thing I don't like about it is like it's too, I think of it too literally. I'm like, but it's not a book club.
Literary.
It can't be a book club for movies.
Literary. No.
It's a movie club for movies.
Right. Anyway, welcome to the show. This is our final week of Oscar Madness March. The March Madness stuff tricks up my tongue. And we're wrapping up with David's pick, which is The Sting. The 1973 caper from Robert Redford and Paul Newman. We're going to talk about that later, but first, let's catch up a little bit on what's been going on here in our worlds. What you guys been watching lately? Have you gone to the movies? Have you seen anything new on streaming? What's been piquing your interest?
No, my A-list is just burning a hole in the wallet at the moment because I haven't had a chance to go to the theater since Dune 2. There's several that I need to catch up on, but I think that we've all had a chance, at least in this podcast room, to talk about or to watch the new investigation, discovery, and docu-series of Quiet on the Set, which hits all our nostalgia buttons in ways we didn't necessarily want or hope for. All of the tragic, terrible things coming out of Nickelodeon and all of those producers. So that has not been great, but a very interesting series to watch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. David, you put that you watched that as well. I also watched a good bit of that. I watched 3 episodes. I still got that last one to go. But I know, Garrett, you've got a big history with Nickelodeon as a kid. I did too. David, I never quite remember. You were genuinely more of a Disney Channel kid, weren't you? Or were you Cartoon
in
Network
some ways.
Kid?
Oh, I was kind of... I mean, I kind of feel like I bounced around all of them. You know, if I wasn't watching Nickelodeon, I was watching Cartoon Network. If I wasn't watching Cartoon Network, I was watching Disney. Like, I kind of did all... You know, Fox Kids, I watched that. ABC's One Saturday Morning. So, I mean, I was all over the place. But specifically, I loved like all that and Kenan and Kel.
Right.
I loved the Amanda Bynes show. So a lot of this was kind of disturbing from a fan of in that perspective for these shows.
Mm-hmm.
The kinds of weirdly inappropriate and just sort of reckless behavior that could be seen that they describe as having happened.
Mm-hmm.
Even outside of the major allegations of sexual assault and things like that, you know, they would work these kids way past child labor law regulations. And it just seemed like a dream when you watched as a kid to be on all that
Be
on the Amanda show.
Well, and some of the cast members interviewed literally say that it was a dream
mm-hmm.
and it became a dream come true for them when they got cast.
I think every kid, to an extent, probably has a dream of being on a TV show. It just seems so cool, whether it was all that or whether it was whatever, Boy Meets World, who cares? It was like such a cool idea to be on TV, but the reality, and what I've heard, and we've heard a lot of child actors describe what the life is like. It sounds like it would just be so emotionally and mentally taxing for any kid, any under 11-year-old.
I don't know what eras of all that you guys watched, but I was particularly interested in seeing Kyle Sullivan pop up again. Do you guys remember him at all?
I
forgot about him until I saw him pop up as a kid, and I was like, oh my God, that kid was really funny on all that.
He was.
And his stories about the on-air dares were...
Mm-hmm.
Horrifying in their own right, and something I don't even really remember seeing.
I have vague memories of On Air Dare, but I don't remember like being excited to watch it.
Yeah, that's not the era of all that I'm familiar with, but that kid was familiar. I think he was also in some other shows and popped up here and there because
he was on the war really, at home.
Yeah,
he was really familiar. And so I when I saw him in real life or in 2024 life, he was like so different looking. It's crazy. But yeah, I don't remember the on air dares, but you know, them putting those kids in those Fear Factor situations is, oh my, like. I don't remember which one it was, but they like dunked them head first into some kind of slime looking thing. I'll say it because it was Nickelodeon, but like how that would
was just being slimed not enough? When did we need to dump scorpions onto children? Like that was where worms it was like okay, that. You want to do a Fear Factor thing, but actually make it for kids. This is just what Fear Factor is. That's not okay.
Yeah. Well, and like Fear Factor, there's like a I signed up to do this. This was just like taking the kids already under your employees and just putting them through it.
Why? It's not. It's
and then the brunt of the whole thing is mostly to do with the sexual misconduct that was on the set with various employees. I mean, unfortunately, like too many. Like, I mean, when the next one came up, when like a third one that they didn't even really bother going into came up, I was like. I was like, is there anywhere that's safe to have a kid working? No. And like, it's just seemed now, you know, a lot of the people they had on, they would say like, look, from my experience, I didn't have that happen to me, but it's really, you know, like it's shaking to find out someone you worked with was doing that type of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it was hard to watch. I thought the documentary itself was a little bit manipulative at times. I just kind of felt like what they would do was they would key in on your Nickelodeon nostalgia by showing you something you liked, and then they would immediately just cut off that feeling by here comes the darkness. Like, you know, you could literally hear the music go like it was just, I don't know, it was like trying to get you in a vulnerable state when they bring you all this stuff in. So I thought, you know, content-wise, it was pretty good. I thought that they had a lot of their sources cited. They obviously were able to get Drake Bell to come and actually talk about his experience. You know, I kind of feel like they probably could have focused it a little more. Maybe this could have not had, I don't know if this needed to be four parts. So I don't know. As a documentary as a whole, I think they could have probably gone deeper with less show, if that makes any sense. But man, it was hard to watch.
Garrett, what else did you react to from it? Anything in particular?
You know, for me, it was watching these people say these things, and then, you know, the people that were on the set that had been convicted for all of these sex crimes, and then they show you some of those skits like Pickle Boy, and the fact that it is, you know, the guy that was convicted or, you know, all of that. And then Ray Romano eating the pickle the way that he was eating it, the stuff with Ariana Grande, like those things, that milk and the potato, those scenes that were just put on air, you know, out of context, they're weird going back and watching them. But you could see how some of that could have been funny in a way back then. But knowing everything that goes into it, it is absolutely disgusting. Because that is an era that I didn't watch. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd stopped watching by that point in time, so I didn't see a lot of those skits. But seeing them that first time with the knowledge was not good.
Yeah, there are these things where kids would think they're silly jokes, but adults could easily see the innuendo in them. And it's just gross to have a child doing the joke, like, yeah, the Pickle Boy stuff is very weird. Just a lot of it is. And then, yeah, just the extent of the abuse that happened under the watch. There's so many adults. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's wild. It was bad. So, I mean, I think it's worth it. I haven't finished it, so I've got a couple of episodes that I still need to watch. So, but it's definitely worth a watch. It's interesting and, you know, tragic. Also, I feel like, Josh, that could qualify for the watch that you did. Interesting and tragic. What is it, a horror movie with that is taking the indie horror world by storm, I assume?
Yeah, I went and saw the new movie Immaculate, starring Sydney Sweeney as a nun. It is a new horror film that she also produces. This is a movie that, from what I understand, she really spearheaded in getting made. She's really like becoming some kind of like her own Margot Robbie style producer, which is kind of cool to see for,
good for
any
her.
Young performer. Anyway, absolutely. So she got this movie made. It's really bizarre. I'm not going to go into detail of it because it would spoil good chunks of the movie. And it also is really disturbing. Honestly, it is a truly, really disturbing movie.
Great.
In content matter, really. Not necessarily in scares, I will say. It's got some jump scares. It kind of relies on that a little too much. It is really the subject matter. It has very... It's very religious. And it does things that a lot of people are not going to like. And for their reason, good reason. So that's what I will say about that.
Is this a more unsettling kind of horror than like what people think of horror as, like slow burn, uncomfortable, like, oh God, I don't like this.
What do I want to say? It is one of those movies. Here, let me read the Letterboxd synopsis. Cecilia, an American nun of devout faith, embarks on a new journey in a remote convent in the picturesque Italian countryside. Cecilia's warm welcome quickly devolves into a nightmare as it becomes clear her new home harbors a sinister secret and unspeakable horrors. I can't say much more about the plot. It's kind of twisty.
Okay.
It's kind of twisty. So
For some reason, I thought it was like related to The Omen. Is there like a different movie coming out about The Omen?
There's a movie called The First Omen coming out.
Oh, okay.
No. Okay. This movie is about a nun and some weird things going on in the church. So.
Tale as old as time, as they say.
If anybody saw the movie Mother, I could compare it to that in some very specific ways.
I haven't seen it, don't. It's, no.
If you're into like messed up horror though, I think you'll like it. It does have, It's one of those movies where it's got a good Rotten Tomatoes score from the critics and a bad one from the audience, which is like, oh yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
But you'll see why if you watch it.
If you let us sit. I don't think I'll like it at all.
Nope, I think you would absolutely not find it even interesting. And you would say it doesn't make sense, and you'd be right.
If you've seen anything new and that's actually fun that I would like, let us know in the comments below.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got anything else we want to talk about, or should we just move on into the topic of the week?
Let's get into it.
The Sting was a huge hit when it came out on Christmas of 1973. David, why don't you tell us a little bit about just how big of a hit it was?
You know, it was a huge hit. Like you said, it came out on Christmas Day. That said, it wasn't an immediate rise to fame. According to Variety's archives, when the movie opened, the number one movie of that weekend was still... Serpico, and even though The Sting, I guess, continued to churn along, it didn't hit number one at the box office until the weekend of April, which would have been when it won Best Picture. It got a big boost from its Best Picture win, and then was the number one movie in America for 2 weeks, got knocked off for a week by Blazing Saddles, and then back at the top through the month of May in 1974. So it had a good run before it finally got there. It finished 1973 as the number two movie of the year, only behind The Exorcist. And it finished its worldwide gross final run with $156 million in the United States, which is still good enough to be number 386 all time, although, according to an article from Box Office Mojo back in 2018, adjusted in for inflation, this is as of 2018, so before a lot of things came out over the last 6 years, however long it's been, it was the number 20 movie adjusted for inflation all time. So it's, I don't know if that's still the case. Box Office Mojo doesn't let you see adjusted for inflation stats anymore. So hard for me to know. I don't know how to convert money rates from 1973. So we'll see. The only other thing I want to say about the box office stats is that this was, I have this little stat for somewhere down here. This Academy Awards was the first year that the top three movies at the box office were all nominated for Best Picture. Those being The Exorcist, The Sting, and American Graffiti. So as of 2023, as of the 2024 Best Picture, you know, still hasn't happened again. So a little interesting detail there. That's really all else I've got to say. So your final total again, $156 million, and about $79 million in 1973. I keep wanting to say 2023. Anyway, that's it. Any questions?
No questions. All right, we'll move on. This week we're talking about The Sting, which Letterboxd describes as set in the 1930s. This intricate caper deals with an ambitious small-time crook and a veteran con man who seek revenge on a vicious crime lord who murdered one of their gang. This, of course, stars Paul Newman and Robert Redford. David, this was your pick for Oscar March Madness. Why don't you tell us why?
Well, last year I was on a bit of a Western kick, and I watched Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid for the first time. This was with Paul Newman and Robert Redford, and I just absolutely loved it. I thought it was a fantastic movie. It was really refreshing, and I remember doing all this reading about it after watching it. And I had noted then that, oh, they worked together another time for Best Picture winner, this thing. And I didn't really think of anything about it because it was August of 2023. Then we decided, hey, let's do Best Picture winners. And I remembered, like, well, you know what? I just read about one that was, you know, the reunion of Robert Redford, Paul Newman, and the director of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, George Roy Hill. And so I just thought, well, let's give that a shot. I love that first one so much. I did consider some other movies. I considered Argo and Moonlight, Schindler's List, all movies that are very good. But I kind of like Garrett when he talked about In the Heat of the Night. And I wanted to go older. I wanted to go with something that might challenge our sense of what a film looks like. Because this is from 1973. So yeah, that's mostly why I picked it. I was really into Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, and this was the second movie they did together, so I was excited for that.
Garrett, had you seen it before?
No, and David, I thought you were going to say, much like In the Heat of the Night, it goes back to Matlock. I thought that's where that was going to go, and I was very excited for
all
that.
All roads go to Matlock.
They do, especially in that episode of The Simpsons. They really needed that Matlock Express, but that's beside the point. I had not seen this. It was my first time. And you know what? I watched it twice for the show. Ooh. Because the first time it wasn't necessarily what I was expecting at all. And so I needed a moment to kind of process. And then I wanted to go back and watch. And so I made it about halfway through. And it really helped with the story. And I found it such an interesting dynamic of a piece where it was, the story was really interesting and captivating the second time. And I was really interested in what they were giving me as a story and how it was pieced together and the way that it was and the detail and the thought. And I didn't get that the first time because I was so thrown off by the production that I didn't expect. You know, I didn't expect the ragtime and I didn't expect the montages and all of those things that I was just so thrown off on. And so, but I came to enjoy because it's a really fun piece of charming film. But, you know, sometimes things are set in a certain era where they don't necessarily carry over as much. And I think that some pieces just didn't hit as well as I feel like they would have in 1973.
What about you, Josh? Did you see this before?
I had never seen this particular Best Picture winner before. And I would say I had a very similar reaction to Garrett, although I did not watch it a second time or a second halftime or anything. But I was very thrown and don't think I got what I expected. And that's no one's fault, I guess. But yeah, the ragtime threw me for multiple reasons. It just seems so off, for one. And for another thing, it's just not what was popular at the time either.
Oh, you'd be wrong.
Oh, I would?
You'd be wrong. There was a huge resurgence in ragtime in the early 70s.
No. Ragtime was not a thing in the 30s.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a thing in like the 12s.
Well, so that's what I'm saying. It was not right even for the era, so it threw me off. Mm. And then, yes, this movie did kick off a very bizarre resurgence where the ice cream truck song went to number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100. That was a fun fact I wanted to mention because I am just still struggling to imagine people in the 70s driving around town with do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do blasting out of their radio speakers, but it's number 3. Anyway, that's a tangent. The music really threw me is what I have to say there.
I love, by the way, just casually, all three of our Best Picture winners have, like, music has been a big element.
Well, sure.
In terms of, like, ragtime, classical music got a bit of a resurgence in the 80s. We had a bluesy Ray Charles number within the Heat of the Night. Mm-hmm. We went all right.
Now, the movie part, there's a lot of it I did like. These guys are so freaking skeezy. They're charming with their good con men, and so that's fun to watch. Yeah. It's fun to watch these capers, even though I do get thrown off every time it turns into a weird Scott Joplin chase.
I'll admit that was the same. That's the same with Butch Cassidy.
Is it really?
And
I haven't
Kid.
Seen that either.
There is a weird montage in Butch Cassidy that it's where a certain song was created. The movie song was created for that movie, and it sticks out like a sore thumb. Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about that another day.
There's parts that are really funny. I did like laugh out loud a few times at some moments that just kind of just unexpectedly tickled me. I did feel it was a little overly long.
Really?
Yeah. I thought two plus hours was a little much for any ragtime.
It's like right at 2 hours. It's like 2 hours, 5 minutes.
Mm.
So this was like, I think, the shortest of the ones we did.
Mm. Mm. It's also the silliest by a country mile. Yeah, I thought it was too long. I just can't say I get it. I truly don't get it.
I think you need to go back and watch it again after having processed it. Because for me, I strongly got Ocean's vibes. Like,
yeah,
the level that these people went to pull off this con and the detail that they had and honestly their personalities and who they are as actual actors. I mean, Paul Newman and Robert Redford were the George Clooney and Brad Pitt were the Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin of their time, right? I mean, like, it's very just interesting to see that dynamic in there. And I really think that the way that they set up the con and the wire and the structure, like, I mean, they built all of these fake places and set this man up in such a deep way because he killed this man Luther, and it affected every single person to their core that they were ready to jump on this big mafia boss. And so I think that the story is really strong there. It is just kind of in a package that if you're not expecting it, kind of throws you for a loop because the montages for me, it wasn't necessarily the ragtime. I thought it was kind of silly. It didn't bother me. It threw me, but it didn't bother me. I was like, okay, whatever. I'll accept it. I didn't know it wasn't of the 30s. I figured it was like another resurgence there. So I was like, whatever. But for me, it was like the actual montages where it just felt like it was part of the movie and then they just decided to put the ragtime over it. That was, for me, where I didn't love it. I also thought that some of the transitions were a little silly. They continued to use the wipes and the page turn. I like the page turns, but the actual, like, default star wipes and stuff that they used were not my bag. But
yeah, that was pretty fun stuff.
The production value and the story just really contrasted, and I don't know. Watching it a second time, I really just appreciated the story more.
David, you have not said what you thought of the movie, actually.
Have I not?
No, you just told us why you wanted to pick it, but you haven't told us your thoughts
well,
yet.
Well, I thought we...
I was
wondering if we were going to talk about the how it did the Academies first.
We will, but tell us what you thought.
I love this. Yeah. I have never been happier at the end of a movie that I was kind of nervous to watch, because I picked it and I was like, man, we've done two pretty good movies. Like, I really hope that, like, I don't let us down here. This instantly jumped into an all-time fave for me. Mm. Like, it was, like you said, Garrett, the Ocean's vibe, definitely. I feel like this is, like, the grandfather of heist movies. Like, this, like, so much of what some of my favorite crime movies do, this has. It has sort of, like, morally ambiguous characters where the bad guys technically are good guys and the good guys are technically bad guys, where you have like this crooked cop named Schneider, played by Papio Daniel. It's not his real name, but that's who he is in O Brother Where Art Thou. And you have this big mom boss. I mean, and you mentioned Brad Pitt, George Clooney, Brad Pitt early in his career was compared to Robert Redford just because of how good looking he was, how charming he was on screen. So it was an easy connect to make there. And I was nervous as it started, because I was like, oh boy, this seems really like dense and really like, you know, 70s crime. But then once they started to let those characters be introduced, once they started letting Redford and Robert Earl Jones, who I want to talk about later, and once they Paul Newman started getting involved, I was just like, yeah, these just seem like cool dudes, and they are cool dudes who do cool crimes.
Yeah, there's you always know? I don't these movies fun. Always do such a good job of making a grifter so charming and wonderful. I mean, mm-hmm. any movie or book that is about a grift, you know, the person mm-hmm. who is doing it, they are so charming and you want to root for them. I mean, these guys are conning this man. They're taking it for his money. Now, he's a bad dude. They're the Robin Hood of grifters.
Yes.
You know, they're going after the people that deserve it. But yeah, they're so charming. And then again, for me, knowing kind of their characters a little more and what they're trying to do, man, I really appreciated the performances the second time. I really enjoyed them the first time, but like seeing Paul Newman and what he does and you know, he has this moment before he goes into the first poker game on the train where he is getting prepped and he's getting ready and he's outside the door and he goes,
whew.
And then he opens that door and the first thing you hear on the other side is, sorry I'm late, guys, I was taking a crap. And it was one of the most unexpected and hilarious moments. And you see why he did this. The things that he did to just poke and prod at mm-hmm. this man throughout this whole thing and the character that he created, and they just portrayed that throughout the whole thing. It was just, I don't know, it was this second watch really helped me understand the movie a little more, and so I highly recommend it for you, Josh, as well.
Well, I'm sorry I'm late, guys, I had to crap. It was a very funny moment to me. It was the hardest laugh that I got out of me, and it was my favorite scene just because it was very funny to see him act a fool like that. I enjoy I enjoyed the cons. I do definitely agree that there's no way there's not a ton of details you missed the first time. Just because, I mean, you can tell that it's pretty detailed. I did enjoy the writing. So I do kind of want to try it again and see if what else kind of sticks out and about the story and the characters and all that. I think it's the packaging, is the presentation doesn't kill it for me, but it just like cuts it off from being an all time classic. I'm just gonna have to be in the small end of the minority.
Hey, you know, I think that's okay.
It's like I liked it, but I saw what was nominated for Best Picture that year. Are you kidding me? There's at least two other films about
this. We can talk about that because we haven't done that yet. We'll get back into the movie, but we do want to talk about some of the things that it went up against. Mm-hmm. Because, David, you mentioned it in the box office portion. There are some big mm-hmm. names. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, I can't remember all of them, but American Graffiti and The Exorcist mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. competition, that's pretty stiff right there.
Mm-hmm. It is. You also had Cries and Whispers as well as A Touch of Class. You know, it was, what do I have? I have it here in 1985 for some reason. That's 1974. I mean, it was a big night. I think that you look at the other things it's compared with, And I don't know. I don't know how it ended up winning, because I could see a lot of people as being like, The Exorcist as a horror film just really stands out and stands the test of time. American Graffiti was very popular. But yeah. I don't know. I wonder if it's just I wonder if it was just the star power, or if it was the fact that it's kind of a comedy. It's a lot more, maybe at the time in the 70s, is a little bit more approachable compared to some of the other movies. I don't know. Like, I don't know why they picked it. Honestly, we never really know why they pick Best Pictures.
Yeah. Well, this was mostly a neck and neck race between The Exorcist and The Sting. Both received 10 nominations this year or that year. And if I had to take a guess, it's because traditionally, and even still to this day, the Academy tends to ignore horror films, despite how good they might be perceived by the public and the critics. And The Sting is also a very well-made movie, and it made people feel good. It's got a very fun ending. And
yeah, it has a lot of twists and turns.
That can pay off a lot, too. Like you said, it's a big star vehicle movie. It's different for the time. It's a 1930s set ragtime caper. Mm-hmm. But in 1973, it popularized the music genre that had no business being popular in 1973. So I get why it won in the end, even though, you know, The Exorcist is also still talked about to this day.
And it's interesting because this movie won in between The Godfather and The Godfather Part II. The year before The Godfather was The French Connection. So you had four straight years of crime-based movies winning Best Picture. And I think they were over it by 74 after The Godfather Part II, because the next year was One Flew the Cuckoo's Nest, and then it was Rocky, and then it was Annie Hall. So I think they were like, no more crime movies. We're done with it. But this definitely, when you compare it to like The Godfather, there's more comedy here. There's more humor here. There's more relief here. Like you said, it's a more... There's just an element more fun. And even if, you know, like the packaging doesn't work for some today, I think for them, maybe in 1973, it was nostalgic. It gave some people a feeling of like, you know, we've talked about in the past the 30-year rule or the 30-year cycle. People who were, you know, going to the movies in 1973, some of them were kids in the late 30s and early 40s in the Depression. So this was kind of an interesting time to look back on for them, the way that we would look back on the 90s or 80s or early 2000s in a few years. I think it's a Best Picture. I love it. But I think you're right. I think The Exorcist, the horror genre, frankly, still has a lot to overcome.
Frankly? Still has a lot to overcome. Yeah, for sure. Let's get back to the movie. Well, actually, you know what? Did we list off the other Oscars it won? Because I do want to say real quick, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, Best Art Direction, mm-hmm. Best Costume Design, Best Film Editing, and Best Score Original Song and Adaptation Scoring, which whatever some of those mean. Those are obviously awards that don't exist anymore. A couple of them, I think.
Yeah, they don't exist anymore.
So big night for The Sting. This was not just, didn't just win the one. It did a pretty close to a sweep.
Beloved.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah, you know what? It did not win any acting categories, despite the big name actors that drive this performance. And so I think that is always interesting. Not necessarily, you don't have to win every single award for you to be Best Picture. I just think that it's interesting that these two big-time people reuniting after a big-time movie didn't take home those Oscars.
Yeah, it is. Redford was nominated for Best Actor, didn't win. Robert Shaw was not allowed to, who played Doyle Lonigan, was not allowed to be nominated for Best Supporting Actor because he was third. He was billed third, I guess, which was, I don't know if that's still the rule today or not. But
wow.
So he probably would have, I think, been considered at the very least. And then Newman, I don't know if he's considered co-lead or what, but I don't think he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. So yeah, I think, you know, it's the charm of the performances is kind of what also carried a lot of this movie. So it is interesting, like you said, Garrett.
Yeah, the dynamic between those two, they just know how to work together. And I mean, they are actors, actors, both of them, despite the fact that I grew up knowing Paul Newman for his salad dressing. But
well, who did? Most of us did, you know.
But my grandma, who was a big fan of his acting, also was a big fan of his salad dressing. Sure. So, you know, mm-hmm. It makes sense. They knew the target market back then.
I saw a video with Robert Redford where he was asked about working with Paul Newman. And he was like, oh, gosh, that guy. And he goes, do you eat his salad dressing? And he goes, no, stuff swill. You ever tried it? It's awful. But he says it very tongue-in-cheek the whole time.
And I love that. I love that dynamic in real life because you can feel it on the screen when people have that chemistry. Yeah. It translates. And again, they know how to work together. And it is like a father, son, brother, older brother, younger brother kind of a situation that they bring to you. And they are both so charming in their own ways. And honestly, they're standing up for a good thing in their world. I mean, there's a line that stands out to me, from Robert Redford, that's, you know, he's trying to convince Paul Newman to help him with stuff, and they're getting to know each other for the first time, and Robert Redford's really upset because Luther has died at this point in time, and he wants revenge, man, but he wants to get him where it hurts, and that's in this man's wallet, and Paul Newman is really trying to get some character from him to make sure that he can work with this guy and that it'd be good, and Robert says that, I don't know enough about killing to kill him, but he, you know, implying that he's not a murderous man, but he'll get revenge in a financial way, and he'll go after where he thinks it hurts, and that'll be enough because that's what he knows how to do. And I just really like that. I thought that was a line that, for me, again, in both times that I watched it, I made comments about and really was like, I really like that line. I think it's really well delivered, and I think it really sets the tone of who they are and what they want.
I agree. There's also a great line in that same sequence where Henry sets up this idea of, like, wants to know how far he, you know, how invested he is in this, how far he is willing to go, or what exactly his full motivations are, because he says, basically, I don't want to be here with some guy who decides it's not enough once it's done. You know, once we rip this guy off, if it's not enough and you want to keep going, I'm not in this for a lifelong vendetta. And that's mirrored at the very end of the movie where Hooker looks at Gunnar and says, you're right, Henry, it's not enough, but it's close, you know? And it's like they got him, he's good. They're not going to be living with the bitterness and the rage for the rest of their life. They got what they wanted. So yeah, I think it's a pretty well-written movie in that respect. Like, it's not just gags and goofs. It's like there's a consistency, there's an arc for both of these characters, or specifically Redford's character of Johnny Hooker. Gorndorff is very much kind of a very, like, he's a mentor, he's a teacher, he's been through all this stuff, and so he doesn't want to see him fall into the same things.
You also wanted to talk about Robert Earl Jones as Luther.
I did.
The father.
Robert Earl Jones, I thought for the brief time he's in the movie, was actually a pretty strong character, because at the end of the day, he's the character, the character of Luther is sort of central to what kicks this all off. It is his, murder at the hands of Lonergan's men that kicks this whole thing off. And I do find, I would be interested to see what people think of this from a modern context. It is interesting to see that in 1973, Best Picture winner features two white men, well, a large group of white men trying to avenge the death of a black man, and how in the world of crime, as they present it, they are equal, even if the world may not view them in the outside that way. Like, they view Luther as someone worth fighting it for, worth avenging, worth getting revenge for. I thought he was great. I for what we have, very good.
Yeah, it's a subtle portrayal, but I agree with you, David. That is an interesting thing to point out, because there are some N-words that are dropped in this movie, but it is only done by the criminal or the bad guys, like the actual murderous, villainous bad guys, and those that we are rooting for treat everyone as equal and same. It's again very subtle, but I really appreciated that aspect of the storytelling.
Well, and, granted, trigger warnings for people who that might offend. It is, you know, it is a tough time, but I think contextually, they, you know, the uses make sense. That may not be good enough for some, and I understand that. But like, it's not ever used really, with the exception of like the first use, which kind of is weirdly problematic since he's the guy that robs Luther at the beginning is on the team, you know, but you know, anyway, it's never really used any vitriol. It's very matter of fact, you know, even Luther refers to himself by the N word, and it's just very like, and I assume that was just, at least in the '70s, how they viewed it as being very commonplace at that time. And it was commonplace at that time, unfortunately. But I understand that for some, for many, that's going to be worth noting. So we probably should have noted it slightly earlier, but it is worth noting. I was just going to talk about, you, like you said, the poker scene was, I think, one of the best movie scenes in the movie, the hook where they go on the train, they trick Lonigan into losing a lot of money, and then they so they could set him up to lose more.
Was fun, and I liked the shuffling cards scene on the train as well. Mm-hmm. It was fun. It's mm-hmm. just those are the fun moments I liked.
As a person of magic, I appreciated the skill there.
Newman acting drunk. We kind of talked about it a little bit earlier. Him just needling Lonigan with all the fake names. I love, you know, you guys talked about the him saying he had to crap, but I love that he comes in and he goes, "Well, Lynam, we'll get started here." And he goes, "It's Lonham." And the first thing he does, he doesn't say anything, he just goes, "Burp." He just burps.
Okay, I did laugh out loud at the burp.
And,
I did.
And it was just so disrespectful, but also so unexpected for me. Like, I just never I never anticipate a burp in a movie. I gotta be honest. But he goes, "Lonham." All right. And then they just keep going. Really funny. And also, the fun of that is also, like, as I was watching the first time, it was genuinely kind of tense because you got two people trying to cheat at a card game. Who's going to cheat better?
I know.
So I liked that a lot. You know, we talked about the montage stuff. It's all a little bit, it is a little bit odd, but it's, you know, I let the movie have its fun. I do want to also point out Redford was running in this movie, like a lot. There was so much running from place to place. It's the only way to get anywhere in the 30s.
Maybe that's where it's just Tom Cruise got it.
I also loved him hopping on the street sweeper as it went by. That made me giggle a little bit. And then one more scene I just want to call out here is there was an assassin in this movie. What a twist. What a twist when we find out who the deadly assassin actually was. And it's so funny because in 1973, this was a PG movie. And that woman just gets capped in the head. And I went, "Oh."
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was not expecting that.
That shocked me too. Even, yeah. Yeah. 1973 was like, whoa. No cutaway, no nothing. Just boom. And then that, right, and then the that bright and ketchup out, red blood they used back then.
And then, yeah, he comes over and he goes, the guy comes over and he goes, "That was Maria Salino." And I was like, "That was Salino?" I was like, what a twist. What a modern twist of that was actually the hitman the whole time.
Nice.
So I really, you know, I loved the twists and turns. I loved, we're already in spoiler territory, so I'll just keep going. When the two FBI guys come to talk to Schneider. And I was like, I wonder if this is a con. But then I remembered that at the beginning of the movie, they had showed us an actor was playing FBI agent Polk. And I was like, oh, well, he was FBI agent in the credits. So maybe he's telling me. And it was very, they played it really well. And so I was like, oh, I guess he's a real FBI agent. And I thought, so I was there. I was with them as they were going, as Robert Redford was going through his dilemma of whether or not he was going to turn on his best friend. Or his new best friend, and I love it. They got me, and when it was revealed, I was like, I knew it. I didn't know it, but I knew it. That specifically is what kind of gave me big Ocean's vibes when, you know, when at the end of that movie, there's just a swirl of twists coming out, and so that was a lot of fun.
All right. Well,
I wanted to call out just one more performance, okay. And that was that of Eileen Brennan's. I always appreciate Miss Peacock and will bow down to her and her performances all of the time. But I thought she was really good as a madam. Man, she was. I want her on my team. Sign me up. She keeps a secret. She keeps her calm. She keeps her cool. And she stands up to dicks. And you need people who stand up to dicks in your life. She poured that cop a little shot glass of beer with, like, already drunk beer. And that moment was, like, good for her. He poured it on her hand after that. But you know what? She was like, whatever, man. I ain't here for you. And I really liked what she did and being able to show her skills as a pickpocket. You know, there was a lot of nuance to a character that didn't have a lot to do, but had a lot to do for that movie.
Yeah,
so everything that she did was really vital and important. And I thought that she did a really good job.
100%.
All right, let's get into our final thoughts and ratings. I'm going to start by reading off Andrew's. He wanted to be on this episode, but had to cancel at the last minute. However, he did send us in his review that he posted on Letterboxd. So let's go ahead and read that real quick to set off the vibe. 5 stars. The Sting is one of my absolute favorite movies of all time. Paul Newman and Robert Redford's buddy chemistry only add more charm to the brilliant writing of David S. Ward. There are so many elements that make The Sting a classic, besides what has already been mentioned, but the clean direction of this caper lies in the hands of George Roy Hill, woven together amongst a backdrop of Depression-era Illinois. High-stakes gambling, a dash of mystery, a little comedy, sprinkled with excitement, what else could top this masterpiece? Oh yeah, that wonderful Scott Joplin score. Definitely one of the most perfect and satisfying movies ever. 5 stars again from Andrew Nichols.
Well said by Andrew. You know, some people have AI. We have AN, Andrew Nichols.
Wait, I got Andrew GPT. All right, who wants to follow? Actually, you know what? Let me follow that because I'm going to be the disappointing one of the bunch, clearly. Yeah, and I don't even know how to, like, I wasn't in love with it. I just liked it. I think it was a mostly fun movie. I just don't know that I get the hype. It's got a lot going for it. But, like, again, I'm like, man, the Exorcist, that's my vote for Best Picture in that year. And this is just perfectly good. So I'm going to be – there's a lot of technical things I like. So I'm going to give it 3.5.
3.5. Okay. Sorry. Garrett, what about you?
Yeah, I have really enjoyed what I've seen and paid attention to more this round, and so I'm appreciating more of the story and that. So I think I wish I could do this on Letterboxd, but I'm not quite there because, again, I think the package for me initially threw me off. But when I sit down to watch it again and I pay attention to what the content is, it's really good, and I'm really enjoying it. And I think that a lot of thought went into certain elements of it. So I'm going to give it like a 3.75 for the production and things like that, because you can't do that in Letterboxd, which I disagree with, but you know what? Sometimes you just kind of have to break the rules. I think this is, you know, again, on my scale, four stars are great, but I'm not quite there, but I feel like it's very, very, very strong.
I'll give you that as I do the numbers tally later. And then I'm going to hike up the whole score here. Because yeah, it is clearly an influential movie. I got so many, you know, so many different feelings while watching it in terms of like movies that I've loved in the past that made me I kind of feel like, the last time a crime film won Best Picture would probably either be No Country for Old Men or The Departed, depending on how you think about those movies. And I don't know. I love a good crime thriller. I love that. I love Westerns. I love all that stuff. So this was my stuff. It was great. It's now one of my favorite movies of all time. So I'm going to give it 5 stars with Andrew. And I'm going to hike this overall score of ours up quite a bit. Could not recommend it more.
Okay. All right. Great. That is we got a wide range of reviews here for y'all. So let us know what you thought of The Sting if you watched it with us or if you've seen it before. You can do that by checking us out online. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and TikTok. Just follow at So Many Sequels Pod. All right, guys. It's time to play the Letterboxd game where we all take a stab at where we think the Letterboxd community has ranked this film on a 0 to 5 scale. Letterboxd is our favorite social media platform for movies. You can follow each of us and the show at So Many Sequels Pod on there. We would love to be your friend on Letterboxd and share views and all that fun stuff. So go check us out there. David's going to be the first person to guess. The two-time champion is behind right now in the standings, which we love to see. I'm going to read a few of the most popular reviews on Letterboxd for The Sting, and then we're all going to take a guess at where we think this is going to land. All right, here we go. 5 stars. The color palette they used to grade this is 100% just a way to make Paul Newman's eyes look bluer and the blood on Robert Redford's mouth look redder, and you know what? I agree. 4.5 stars. Robert Redford has Brad Pitt face. 4 stars. So classical, it might as well have been actually filmed in 1936. And 4 stars. 1930s uncut gems.
I did want to mention, I am a little upset that not that Paul Newman wasn't nominated for Best Actor or Supporting Actor, but the fact that his eyes were not nominated for Best Supporting Actor was a travesty amongst itself.
Yeah.
It's true. He's got a great set of eyes.
Cal Ripken Jr. blue.
I noticed a lot of blue eyes in that movie. I don't know, something about the color. They're right. They're onto something there.
Well, all of those most popular reviews are very high.
Right. So where are you thinking, David? You're the first guess.
Gosh.
We had some fives in there, some fours, some 4.5s, I think.
I every week of Best Picture Month has been so hard because they're all like they've all been like 4
plus. I mean, yeah, generally speaking.
I think so.
People like the best
pictures. They're best pictures.
I'm going to say, gosh, this is so hard. I'm going to say 4.2. I'm going to guess it's 4.2.
But okay. 4.2. Okay, well, I mean, dang. You drive a hard bargain because it would be very difficult to get myself to go higher than 4.2, especially with my review of the film. But I can't consider mine because I didn't see any in there that were 3.5 in the first page or two of results. So I'm still going to underscore you a little bit, though, just not as far as me, and I'm going to go down to a 4.0 even.
4.0. All right.
You know, our guess as a team, as a average So Many Sequels, was what, 4.3?
4.3 when you add in Andrew.
Okay. Oh. But without him, it was a 4.1, right?
And it was like 4.0, basically.
4.0, yeah, 4.08. Okay, that's 4.1. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take our average. That's what was my guess, too.
Oh, boy.
Because everything that we've done has been 4.0, and it has been above every single time, right? So I don't think, I mean, I could go 4.5, which is possible, but I don't think I'm going to do that.
Okay.
We're all cramped up here at the top.
We keep doing that.
This
Letterboxd game's been silly.
A direct hit.
Hey, I direct it.
With 4.2. David has scored a double.
My moment.
Damn.
My moment. Your moment.
Nice.
I'll tell you what, I got a direct hit on In the Heat of the Night, too. I know. So now I'm back up in the lead.
You're heating up the charts, and I don't like it.
Well, not the lead. I'm tied with Garrett.
I don't like this. Garrett, we have to fix this.
Let's see
here. I'm in the lead. I don't know what you're talking.
Tally this number.
He's tied with me.
I'm tied with Garrett. Me and Garrett.
Forgets to add ties. He likes to confuse people with the numbers and statistics. Like last year, he kept being like, "Well, yeah, you have 47 points, but you only have 2 direct hits." he kept confusing me, thinking I was doing. Making me think Garrett. I was doing better than I was doing, and you'd be like, "Oh yeah, you have 2. You're leading in direct hits, but you're last in points." So good for you.
Because Garrett, you would even this year. You have 4. With 3 wins. I have 4 with 2 wins. So, like, that's the amazing...
No, you're just being... No.
But it's interesting. No. It's interesting. No, it's I've got 2 direct hits putting me at 4. You've got 4 points.
You're the only one who finds that interesting. You're
you're
outvoted.
You're just being the little cousin at the sleepover.
You're voted off the island.
Garrett wins...
Well, actually...
I'm just saying Garrett wins more, but I win better. That's all I'm saying.
No.
Okay.
But don't make no difference. Never mind.
This is getting competitive, y'all.
Garrett, you've got more rushing yards. but I've got more carries. You've got more carries, I've got more yards.
His arguments just don't make sense. It's just numbers and statistics that aren't important.
Well, you know.
You can bend statistics to anything.
Hey, if you're a fan of the Letterboxd statistics, get in the comments. Let us know what you think. Are you pro knowing how many times Garrett's won, but how many direct hits
exactly,
he has?
Exactly.
Let me know.
All right. That's it for this show. Next week, we'll be kicking off a brand new month. Stay tuned for that. We'll be announcing that here on our YouTube channel and our podcast feed, as well as our social media channels. So check those out. We got links to all that at somanysequels.com. Again, we're on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and TikTok. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, where if you do that, you can get access to our Discord. So be sure to do all that. Oh, and we are getting closer and closer to hitting our YouTube goal. Our next, what do they call them, like flex goals when they change along the way? Our next flex goal is 121. We're at 119. Mm-hmm. So a couple more people. Hit that subscribe button if you have enjoyed any of this video or any of our other videos. We would appreciate it a lot. We'll see y'all next time with a brand new month, brand new theme here on So Many Sequels.